So last week we discussed more generally the value of custom, the legal value, the emotional value, experiential value of customs, leading us into the night of the Seder itself, where obviously the customs of the Seder in all its manifestations, in the halachic forms, in the local customs and family customs, all those come to play in a very intense way on the night of the Seder. So what we're going to do now is, both in terms of the customs I've chosen at least so far to speak about, and in customs that anyone wants to present, we have at least one today. Nancy, if she's feeling better, will present next week. You're going to present next week, if anyone else wants to, or today? Okay, so we can bracket off, then I'll bracket off, let's say, 10 minutes at the end. Okay, so I put here five different customs. Now, three and a half of them, let's say, are kid-friendly, and one of them is not. We'll start with the one that's not, because I wanted to do at least one custom which we all misunderstand. And so I wanted to start with a custom we all misunderstand. This was enlightening to me when I first encountered this in graduate school. And then we'll move to ones that can be understood by a more general audience. But the first one's a lot of fun. So, I mentioned last week, not all customs are either correct, and not all customs even that are correct are properly understood, so I wanted to at least bring one which we really don't understand. At least most people don't, I think. So the first custom I want to start with is the custom of the 16 drops of wine. Now, what's the 16 drops of wine? We don't actually ever do anything with 16 drops of wine at the Seder, right? So some people don't even have 16, but there was at some point a custom 16, the 10 plagues, then the three of the acronym of Rabbi Yehuda, right, that we divide the Maggid into three. And then you'll see in some Haggadot, it will say a little bit earlier when it says, Dam va'esh v'timrod ashan, right, blood and fire and the pillars of smoke, it'll say you drip three drops also. There are 16 drops of wine at the Seder that are dripped onto the side. Some people drip it, some people pour it, some people do whatever they do. Different. With their finger. You know, they don't pour it back into their cup, or they do it with their, you know, some people do it with their pinky, some would do it with their pointer, whatever people do, different versions of it. Now, this custom, in whatever form it is, if I asked you, right, and, you know, don't be afraid to be incorrect historically, because this is what, as we will see, everybody thinks, even though it's probably not right. Why do we spill a little bit of wine at the Seder? Why do we spill these drops of wine? Well, that's for sure true. That's the rule of everything at the Seder. But why do we do it, right? What motivates us to spill this wine at the Seder?
Because then we have less wine. Because no, it's true. So you cannot enjoy it because
we suffered. Right, so the classic one is because we want to diminish our happiness because the Egyptians suffered. Yeah. Right? That's the standard answer that you'll find in almost every Haggadah. And we'll see every Haggadah from every denomination. That happens to not be true. Now, it's a nice reason, and it may add meaning to it, but I want to do at least one sort of... this is what, you know, like I said, I did this first in graduate school. I wanted to do one, like, academic, you know, see what it would be, what it takes sometimes to trace a minhag back, a custom back, and see where it actually came from before all, you know, the later accretions. Okay, so source one. This is the family participation Haggadah, a different night. So this is a pretty standard Haggadah you can buy in a store, which says exactly what you said. By spilling a drop of wine from the Pesach cup for each plague, we acknowledge that our own joy is lessened and incomplete. For our redemption has to come by means... This is source one, where on page... she stapled them together, so it's, I guess, the fourth page. It's where it starts a new heading, Customs of the Seder 2.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just... It's in the same, you know, thing, just, you know, a few pages in. Okay. For our redemption had to come by means of the punishment of other human beings, even though these are just punishments for evil acts. It says, do not rejoice at the fall of your enemy. And this is the standard explanation that's given. Nothing to do with the specific numbers, the 16. It's just, we drip wine at the plagues and because the Egyptians suffer. Okay, now what's the history of this? Where did this come from? So, look at source 2. This is a very nice article in a journal, Chakira, which is a journal, sort of an eclectic, academic, ish journal that comes out from Brooklyn where people can be basically put whatever they want in. So it includes some academic, some straight halachic issues, some what they call rabbinic opinion, some history, so a little bit of this, a little bit of that. So there was a nice article by Tzvi Ron a few years ago on this topic, and the article was called "Our Joy is Lessened and Incomplete, the History of an Interpretation of 16 Drops of Wine at the Seder." So he writes as follows. The disseminators of the incomplete joy explanation generally relate it to the reason given in the Midrash for the recital on Sukkot of the full halal every day. But on Passover, only on the first day, the rest having the abbreviated halal. So he said, where does the idea come from that we want to diminish our joy at the Seder? So I'll summarize it outside, then we'll look at his summary inside. So, actually, his summary is pretty good. So he said, the halachic reason for this, found in the Talmud, is that on Sukkot, there are different musaf sacrifices offered each day, so each day of Sukkot is considered a distinct holiday. Whereas on Pesach, the same musaf sacrifice is offered each day. Okay, so the Talmud has the following question. On each day of Sukkot, what we call the full halal is recited. The full halal means that we include all paragraphs. What we call half halal or partial halal really just cuts out two halves of two paragraphs. It's not really that much. It's a difference of about 10 verses, 15 verses maybe. But and the difference also at some point or in some communities is whether or not you say a bracha when you say halal. Now, in most Ashkenazi communities, they will say halal every day of Pesach, even when they're not saying complete halal. But in Sephardi communities, that's not true. They won't say a brach on the days of the quote-unquote half halal. So the Talmud says, why is it that every day of Sukkot we have full halal? And on Pesach, we don't. Only on the first day, the first 2 days. So the Talmud simply says, because every day of Sukkot is considered a unique holiday, because you bring different numbers of sacrifices each day. You start with 14, then you have 13, then you have 12. So each day is identifiable as a distinct holiday because there's different sacrifices. On Pesach, that's not the case. You bring the same number of sacrifices every day, and therefore, after the first day, everything is just a repeat, is a continuation of day one, so you don't say a full hollow. That's what's found in the Talmud. But the Midrash adds a different reason, right? Another answer, however, is found in the Midrashic literature. That the reason only an abbreviated halal is recited after the first day of Pesach is that the Egyptians drowned, and, quote, if your enemy falls, do not exult, right, from Proverbs. This seems to be based on the episode based in the Talmud in Megillah 10b, that when the Egyptians were drowning in Yam Suf, God silenced the angels who wanted to sing, saying that it's not appropriate to do so when his handiwork is drowning in the sea. So the Talmud in another place tells the story that the angels wanted to sing at the splitting of the sea, and God said, don't. You can't sing when my handiwork, when my children, when human beings are suffering, are dying in the sea. So the Midrash uses this to explain why we don't say complete Hallel throughout Pesach, because we want to diminish our joy, acknowledging the fact that even though, yes, we went free, there were those who had to suffer in order for us to go free. However, as he notes, it should be noted, however, that the Israelites themselves did sing Shirat Hayam at this point. Right? The big problem with this explanation is God stops the angels from singing because it's wrong for an outsider to sing at the downfall of God's creatures. But the Jews themselves were saved. So it might be sad, but you're allowed to rejoice in your own salvation, yes, even if it's at the cost of your enemies, your oppressors. That's what it means to be human. And this was not viewed as problematic. So whatever the merits of this particular Midrashic explanation for not reciting the full halal throughout Pesach, it does not seem to apply to the custom of removing drops of wine from the cup, since that is done on the Seder night, when we do in fact recite the full halal and do not limit our joy. And he adds, not only did the Jews sing at Kriyat Yam Suf, at the splitting of the sea, on Seder night, we actually say a complete halal, more than a complete halal. We have full halal plus a whole bunch of other things that we add into it. So if it were true that the reason that we spill this wine is to mourn or to express sorrow at the fact that the Egyptians had to suffer in order for us to go free, you would expect that to manifest itself in the original custom which is affected by that, i.e. Hallel. And it's not, if anything, we say more Hallel. And it makes sense because Seder night, we're re-experiencing the Exodus. And in the Exodus itself, we did not mitigate our own joy. The angels, so to speak, did. But we didn't. We were the ones being saved. Now, before we get to where it comes from, just to show how pervasive this is, because thank you for being the guinea pig here with the sacrifice on it. But it is everybody who thinks this. And this was to me was fascinating. I knew the historical background, but he did the 20th century history, which I didn't know. So he just went through many different Haggadot from the 20th century from all denominations. And he said, this explanation is so entrenched, and he writes like this, in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, this explanation became ubiquitous in American Haggadot. The explanation is presented in the introductory note by Lewis Finkelstein into a 1942 English translation Haggadah. Quote, the spilling of wine at the mention of the plagues is interpreted as a symbol of regret that the victory had to be purchased by the death of the Egyptians. Finkelstein was the dominant figure of conservative Judaism in the 20th century and was chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary at the time he wrote that introduction. So that's the conservative movement. Now, the Orthodox movement, the Haggadah edited by David N. Tamar de Solopoul, first published in 1943 by the National Jewish Welfare Board for members of the Armed Forces of the United States, similarly explains that a drop of wine of rejoicing is diminished from the cup in sign of pity for the suffering Egyptians. This Haggadah, composed by a committee of Orthodox, conservative, and Reform rabbis for Jewish soldiers who were fighting in World War II, addressed the compatibility of Jewish and American values. Right, so this was so entrenched that this board of, it was David de Solopoul himself was Orthodox. The Haggadah was written by members of the three major denominations in the States for American soldiers, and it was specifically picking up on those values that are compatible, that are American and Jewish values where they are compatible. The American value here is, quote, the liberal ethic believing that all people are essentially good, so that punishing the Egyptians seems so vindictive and vengeful. The Haggadah, edited by Philip Birnbaum for the Hebrew Publishing Company in 1953, also states the custom is intended to stress the idea that we must not rejoice over the misfortunes that befell our foes. The Birnbaum Haggadah was considered the standard traditional Haggadah for English speakers until the first Art School Haggadah was published in 1977, and as noted above, also includes this explanation. So, Orthodox, Reformed, Conservative, cross-denominational Haggadot, all of them have this explanation. And it's a nice explanation. It speaks to us, as you said, right? This is the American value that all people are essentially good and that we feel bad when people are suffering. My guess is that because we like the message so much is why we all became convinced that that's where the custom came from so quickly, despite the fact, as he notes, when you think about it, it doesn't really work with the Seder, because the Seder, that's the only thing we do to minimize our joy. Everything else we do is overly exultant because we were redeemed on this night. So where does it come from? So, and here is what often happens in customs, is it's not just the appealing explanations that win us over by virtue of their appealing nature. Often it's because the original explanation is so out of left field that we look for another one. So what's the original explanation? So the original explanation, which goes back as early as Rabbi Lezer HaGadol in the 10th century, but it's quoted here by Lezer of Worms in the 12th century in Germany, writes as follows. For each word a finger goes into the cup of wine, they spell out a drop, matching the sword of the Holy One, blessed be He, which has 16 sides. I have no idea. But there was this mystical tradition that God has a quote-unquote 16-sided sword, and the 16 mentions of plagues in Jeremiah. This custom teaches us that we will not be injured. Based upon this, our ancestors created this custom. And 16 times the word chayim, right, life, and 16 people read the Torah each week, matching the 16 lambs that are sacrificed in a week. Also, He, the gematria of He, right? Eitz Chaim He l'machazikim ba. The Torah is a tree of life. The numerical value of He is 16. And one should not ridicule the custom of our holy ancestors. So the original custom has nothing to do with this nice value. It comes from a totally different world. And there was an entire mystical world especially in Germany in the Middle Ages, that was absolutely obsessed with these number games, right? With seeing numerical values in words, in number of times something appears in the Torah, and matching it up with what we do in our life, and also in all these mystical adjurations of how to bring divine protection, divine whatever, right? Divine wisdom, divine inspiration. They had all types of procedures for this. It was a very heavily mystical world. And this tradition, its original version, is from that tradition. And that's why I start with the 16. We don't even think about the 16. We think about the drops. In the original version, it was the 16 drops that was important, because you were activating God's 16-sided sword for protection. As the Maharil notes, I just put it in a footnote here, that this fits with a different theme that we know from the Seder. We just don't normally connect with this, which is that Seder night is what we call Leil Shimurim, the night of protection. So it is a mystical part of that tradition of the Seder. So that's the original translation. So the explanation for this custom that appears 600 years before the earliest appearance of the "our joy is lessened because people died" argument. So again, I said this is probably not kid friendly, but I wanted to just show is that custom, as we noted, right? Custom, because it's about living experience, often you don't know where it started because it's not really text based, right? It's people live this way. So often we have no idea why we do things. Sometimes we lose the explanation, and you can trace it back. You can find the paper trail and go back and find it. Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. But often it's more lost than it would be, let's say, in halakha, because tradition isn't the type of thing that's subject to text in the same way. We do it because our parents did it, or because it says it in the Haggadah. We don't ask questions, so we're much more likely to, in this case, as a community across all denominations, forget why a custom came into being. Now, the question that I would leave you with is, okay, it's definitely interesting and maybe adds another element to our understanding of the custom to see where it came from. Does that mean that there's no value to the other explanation? No, because as we said, custom is this liminal place between law and, you know, unfettered experience, let's say, or personal subjective experience. So if we can deepen it with another meaning that we all find meaningful, so that's also important. So I don't think it's not important, but pointing to this type of case is a way of highlighting the fact that custom takes on a life of its own, which may be legitimate, but also there's sometimes value to going back and understanding how Jews throughout history experience those same customs. And sometimes, as you have here, the same custom means something very different to different communities. And that's just something I think that's worth thinking about. Yeah?
Rabbi, does that mean that the actual custom of the drops started around then?
Yeah. It started about the 10th century, at least. At least as early as the 10th century.
So, but if it was earlier than that, do we know that was the...
So we know it goes... This is from the 12th century. We know it goes back at least 200 years before that, to Rabbi Elazar HaGadol, the teacher of Rashi, okay, in the 10th century. So we know it goes back very, very far back.
And that was in Ashkenaz in Germany.
And that was in Ashkenaz, exactly. But that was in the Rhineland.
It's possible, yeah, that historically that they did what we did, that they did the same thing we did and had been observed for other reasons before.
It's, yeah, for sure possible. This is the as best as we can tell historically. Now, one more point, then we'll ask a question. What was even more interesting to me is, okay, if I asked you, assuming this is the case, that the original custom was because of this mystical 16-sided sword of God, and it came from that other tradition of the Seder that we talk about God's protection, etc., etc. And if I asked you, okay, by the 20th century, everybody thought that it was about we are mourning the suffering of the Egyptians. And I asked you, take a guess, what type of person first introduced that argument? Right? Because it didn't start in the 20th century, but the 20th century was entrenched. So if you had to guess who introduced it, who would you guess?
A very liberal person,
probably an Enlightenment thinker in the 19th century or something like that. Right? Because, you know, that was happening in the 19th century, is that people in the Enlightenment, especially the more liberal end of the Enlightenment, were taking old customs that were mystical and were reinterpreting them in line with Enlightenment values.
They seized on the Midrash about don't celebrate.
Oh, correct. I mean, the Midrash is...
gave them the jumping up.
Right. The Midrash has this idea. But taking that Midrash, which speaks more to liberal values, and using it to reinterpret a mystical one. So if I had to guess, I would say that's like classic Enlightenment period, liberal custom, right? the sort of liberal agenda in that period. And that's what I would have guessed if I had to guess. It turns out we would be horribly wrong. It was introduced by a Haredi Jew in the 19th century in the heart of Hungary, the most intense anti-reform part of Europe, which I would not have guessed in a million years, which also goes to show that sometimes we should wait before we jump to judge here. I had the same intuition. But if you look in 4, he says, it would seem that the ultimate origin of the incomplete joy explanation is Rabbi Yirmiyahu Lo. Although the I don't know if that's how you pronounce it with the two dots on top, but although the incomplete joy explanation seems to express modern sensibility and possibly political correctness, Yirmiyahu Lo was not known for these characteristics, and in fact was known as a recognized leader of Hungarian Orthodoxy who was a vigorous opponent of Hasidim, Reform, and Haskalah. So that also is just one of those things that I thought, you know, was fun for Seder night. That Seder night we emphasize everyone being at the Seder, not judging everybody, letting everyone come to the Seder and give their thing. So, at least for me, this was a lesson that, you know, I took a guess that this explanation was started in one part of the community, was started all the way at the other end. You never know what someone's going to add to the conversation Seder night if you just let them talk. So that was just a historical quirk that we can learn something from. But yeah, in the actual article, if you read it, you'll see that he also had the same thing. He's like, oh, it seems to be that it's from Reform, and it is early in Reform that you find this explanation. It's just that they in turn derived it from, they quote this passage from this Rabbi Yirmiyahu Lo, who, if you know anything about 19th century history, it's not just that he was like arch anti-Reform. Hungary was the seat of, right, to quote Michael Silber in his article about Hungary in that period. It was, his article on Hungary in that period is called The Ultra-Orthodoxy in Hungary, the invention of a tradition, right? The notion of ultra-Orthodoxy, what's called now ultra-Orthodoxy, was actually invented in Hungary, and this Rabbi Yirmiyahu Lo was actually part of that movement, and yet is giving this, what?
Is this what they call Litvishes?
No, this is like a... It's Hungary. It's the Hungarian. It's the world of the Chassam Sofer, of Moshe Sofer. So it's like this is the seat of what will become known as Haredi Judaism, and that's where this explanation actually comes from. So like I said, sometimes you don't expect who's going to tell you something that's going to speak to you. Okay, yeah.
So we're Sephardic. We hail from Greece, and I have to check our Haggadah, which is a really old Haggadah. Like, I have the ones that come from Greece, never mind the ones that are from here. So, we don't use wine. Why, I don't know, but I have to check. We never used wine in our Seder. We always used water, and the head of the family is the only one who does it. And the part that I wanted to mention is, my parents always said, don't look. Like, we were never allowed to look when they poured it. And I'd say, why? It's because it's a bad thing, if something bad happened. But they never, my parents are survivors, so they don't know all the reasons. They just
right.
have the memories of what
memories
they did.
Of the
interesting.
But we all never looked. And when my kids to this day, I would, don't look. And I never knew why. I never thought about the why. But
interesting.
So.
Interesting. So I don't know.
Fingers.
Right.
We drink all our wine.
Is it 16 drops?
We drink water.
The original custom was 16, and somehow got that you won't.
I'm going to check.
Right.
How did it change from 16?
Well, I think as people probably as people forgot the significance of the 16, and they thought it was just about the spilling of the wine, so keeping 16 wasn't as important. Right? Meaning, as you forget the reason, and you forget that it's about 16, it's not about the drops, it's actually about the 16. So then...
When did that change, that?
I don't know. I honestly don't know.
I think in most of the Haggadot, it's 10 and then 3 and 3.
Well, no, it's still 10 and 3 and 3, but it's total. It's 10, 3 and 3. It's not 16 in a row. It's 10, 3 and 3. Well, 3, 10 and 3, really. 3, 10 and 3, right? Dam Veishtim Rod Ashan, the 10 Makot, and then Ditzah Hadash Ba'achavra, the mnemonic. So 16 total. Right? I should have clarified, right? 16 total, but 3, 10 and 3 in that, right? It's the total. And I think a lot of people only do 13 because they, right? I think, but when you see the original explanation, you see why the 16 was important. From the vantage point of the suffering of the Egyptians, 16, 13, 10, who cares? From this vantage point, you see why there's 16. Okay, so that was just one fun one. Just to sort of understand where things come from, mistakes, and how, you know, how sometimes our expectations, Seder night, can be thrown off if we let it. Okay, so really, here, from now, each of these is a mini topic. So we can start wherever you want. So I don't know how people want to start. The four topics I have on these are the custom, understanding Karpas, the custom of seeing ourselves if we left Egypt, the custom of giving out candy to children, what did I put? I think I put a fifth one. Oh, right, and the custom of leaning. So we can start with any of those and do them in any order. And like I said, there's no pressure to get through them this week. If we don't finish these this week, then we'll continue next week. If we finish them, I'll bring a few more customs in. But we can start wherever you want. There are four mini topics. So,
Start at one.
Two in order.
Karpas in order of the sheets. Sheets. Okay, so we'll just go in order. To not confuse people, then we'll go in the order of the sheets. Fine. So then we'll just continue where we are. So this is two, right? It's Roman numeral two, source five. Right? I divided each topic. Okay, so fine, so we'll go Karpas. Okay. So Karpas. The Talmud already says, why do we have two dips? So the Talmud says, so there'd be something noticeable for the young children. Okay, now we know this is the theme of Seder night, is to get the children involved. So we dip twice, right? Once we're going to dip the maror later in the charoset, but we also do another dipping of the karpas into salt water so that the children will ask. And as we know from source 6, and this is in the Manishtana, right? You pour the second cup, and here the child asks his father, on all nights we dip one time, or alternatively we're not even obligated to dip one time. On this night we dip twice. Okay. So now, before we look at any of the other sources, what's strange about this passage in the Talmud that introduces Karpas? Let's imagine Seder night. According to the Talmud, why do you do Karpas? So the children will ask, okay, good, you come to your Seder and everything goes as planned. You get to your Seder and your grandchild says, Mommy, Daddy, Ima, Abba, whatever, why do we dip the karpas into the salt water? Why do we dip this celery, potato, whatever, into the salt water? And you answer?
Spring, new beginning.
Right, but what does the Talmud not answer? All it says is it gets the children to ask, but it doesn't tell you what happens then, right? The script ends. Here the question, the child asks, and you say what? Right? According to the Talmud, there is no answer. The Talmud doesn't tell you. So, one explanation, skip to 8, is Rabbi Chizkia da Silva, the Pri Chadash, we got to see him a little bit last week, writes exactly what you just said. He said, even though we have nothing to answer to their question, why we dip before the meal, nevertheless, because of it all, they will wake up to ask about other changes that they see. The answer is, there is no answer. The Pri Chadash said, you know what this is? As I heard, I was listening to a shir on the topic by Rabbi Shua Grunstein, and he, I think, has the right characterization of this piece. He said, according to Pri Chadash, Karpas is the icebreaker. We open the night, we want them to ask a question. So at icebreakers, right, we say, tell me your favorite color, right? Or, you know, what is something you've always wondered about? Or anything like that. There doesn't need to be an answer. There doesn't need to have meaning to that. You can forget it 3 seconds later. We just want the kids to ask. So according to the Pri Chadash, there is no answer. The kids will say, why are we doing that? And he said, because we wanted you to ask the question and just keep your eyes out because other things are going to be changing through the night and there's going to be a reason for that. So one possibility is, that's exactly what it is. It's an icebreaker. It gets them to ask. And then what do you do at that point? Either you tell them, I'm glad you asked questions. Questions are good. Or you come up with whatever explanation is meaningful to you because it doesn't have an answer. Right? So the Ruchizkia da Silva just says there is no answer to that question. The value of that question is that it's a question.
But I don't understand. All other nights we dip once. Do we dip? Or what?
Well, so that's why there are different versions. So that's why there are different versions. Right. So right. So that's why I put that there are two different versions of the text. In some, it's we don't even dip once. We
don't even dip.
So in their culture, they usually did dip.
Whose culture?
In the time of the Talmud, right? They did dip. So, but you'll see that there are different versions of the original text. It's either on other nights we dip once, or we don't even have to dip once. So in our culture, we don't necessarily dip. In Middle Eastern cultures, you know, they still dip a lot, right? It's very common just to have
to dip.
Right, whether it be hummus or even not hummus, the oil with za'atar or oil with, right?
But there's no rule of the one or two.
There's no one, two. You just, you know. But there is this this thing of, you know, of dipping. You know, it's the you know, in Israel, that's very common. You know, your first course is salatim, right? It's the salads, right? You just, you know, you dip a little bit of this, a little bit of that. It would be weird. It's very Middle Eastern. But if you... you imagine it, so in Middle Eastern cultures, you start the meal with salatim, with all these little dipping salads, and then you have, you know, then if you had your soup, and then you had your main course, and then before dessert, you brought the salatim out again, someone would ask a question. Right, so that's essentially what karpas is in their culture.
Also, it's very practical. Kids have been sitting there a long time already, they're nudging, so you keep them quiet by giving them something to keep their mouth.
Right, so we're going to come back to that. We're going to come back to that with candy. I think what I'll do is after this I'll skip to candy.
Dipping twice. It's the twice.
It's the twice, exactly.
What is the twice?
The maror. Right, the maror is going to go.
The twice is because of the whole purpose of the Seder. It's different. This night is
right. The twice.
That's what we're going to... Now,
exactly
why
right.
It's different.
Right.
So there is an answer.
Right. So according, so the other explanation is what you said is that, well, Reb Chizkiya de Silva said there is no reason. It's just to make it different, right? But there might be reasons, right? So possibility one is karpas is just the icebreaker to emphasize to the kids. By the way, questions are good tonight, right? That's it. Okay. There are other explanations. You look at seven. So the first anonymous position in Tosfot, right, the medieval collection from France and Germany, says that, yes, again, similar to Ruchiske de Silva, it's only to be something noticeable. It's there so that it's noticeable. That's it. There is no explanation like Ruchiske de Silva. Ryosef Tuv Elim says a very technical halachic reason, and he says there is a dispute whether if you have a raw vegetable during a meal, you have to say a separate bracha, a separate blessing in addition to washing and making the bracha on the bread. And in order to fulfill all positions, so before we have the bread, we eat a vegetable, make the bracha on the vegetable, and have in mind the maror later on, so that when we get to the maror, you don't have to worry about it. So he just says it's a totally technical halachic explanation. This is also very difficult because that dispute is not a Talmudic dispute, it's a medieval dispute. The Talmud was not envisioning that there would be a medieval dispute about its laws. But okay, that's his explanation. In 9, the Bach, Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, suggests three explanations. So the first one he says is, A, for people who are not accustomed to eating a vegetable before the meal, so the dipping before the meal is a way of expressing freedom, as free people dip before the meal to increase one's appetite. So he says, this is part of the theme of the Seder of freedom, of wealth. Because he said, we all know this, hors d'oeuvres don't fill you up, they make you hungrier. Right? You go to a fancy dinner, a fancy wedding, and the person walks around with those little tiny berekas that are this big, and you dip it into the dipping sauce. That doesn't fill you up. That reminds you that you're hungry, so that you then go to the smorgasbord, and then you go from there to the, you know, five-course meal, and then from there to the Viennese table. Right? This is not the end, but you remind yourself you're hungry with a little bit of dipping. Yeah.
Sorry, don't mean to prolong it, but this answer ties in with something I read that the karpas at the beginning are hors d'oeuvres, and it replicates the way wealthy Romans had their feasts at the time.
Right, and that is another right. So that's another version of it would be specifically the Roman. And when we get to the leaning, we'll come back to that. That specifically, there's a Roman aspect to it. But even without the Roman, then we understand that even in our culture, at some level, we dip a little bit before we have hors d'oeuvres, and that is an expression of wealth, of freedom, etc. The second explanation, he says, is what you said before, or similar. The kids are hungry, so we dip now for a taste before the meal, so we won't have to wait the whole time without eating at all. Another possibility is, you're right, there is no real answer to the question. The answer is, we're doing this because we're going to be here for a long time, and we want you to keep asking questions and learn tonight. So have a little bit to eat, have a little bit of a potato, and that will tide you over for the next 3 hours of discussion. I don't know how realistic that is, but okay. The third explanation that he cites from the Maharal of Prague is that it will be noticeable when we do the second dipping, this is what you said before, right, that it's not that people will ask at the karpas. That will generate them asking the question later when we get to the maror, you know, back to our salatim example. No one's going to ask the first course. It's to set up so that when the maror comes out, they'll ask about the maror. And the maror, obviously, when they ask about the maror, we have plenty of things that we can tell them, right, that they made us our lives bitter. It's just that we want to accentuate the uniqueness of the maror. So in fact, karpas, they're not going to ask at karpas. Karpas is going to set the stage for them to ask later on. Okay, in 10, Rabbeinu Manoach, in the 14th century, has another three explanations. He says as follows, and again, the goal of this exercise is to show that sometimes customs have a lot of different reasons, and that's okay. Doing the same custom, the more reasons it invokes, the more emotions it evokes, the better. So here we're just going through a lot, but we'll make a point about this soon. So Rabbeinu Manoach suggests three others, and these are fascinating. So the first one, he says, is we have the custom of karpas. Now, karpas either means this vegetable that we dip, but it also means something else in Hebrew. It also means a turquoise green. It's a color. So he says, and where does it appear? So it appears in two very prominent places in Tanakh. One, which is not relevant to our night, probably, is the coat of Mordechai. That Mordechai has a coat which has karpas. But what is... What? It's multiple things. It's colorful. It also has karpas.
The word karpas is used there?
Yeah. In Chur karpas utchelet. Right? Chur karpas utchelet. But specifically, he says, we have the custom of karpas to commemorate the colorful coat that Jacob made for Joseph, that because of it, the story devolved and our forefathers descended to Egypt. Note, right, as I say, one of the colors was karpas. So he says it commemorates something totally different, the coat of Joseph. Why the coat of Joseph? Why on Seder night the coat of Joseph?
Because he starts the story.
Right, he starts the story because the way the sages understand is not just that it's the technical start of the story, like it is, right? It's that the reason we had to go through the slavery in Egypt was because his brother sold him. So on Seder night, we want to commemorate not just that we are in Egypt, but the message of being in Egypt. The message was, you didn't get along with your brother, so you went down to Egypt. So first things first, we remind ourselves why we went to Egypt, so we will educate ourselves what not to do. Because part of the Exodus is not just remembering God saved us, is why did God save us, for what purpose? And that is to be the type of person we're supposed to be. Among those things is to fix the sin, right, the sin represented in the sale of Joseph. The second explanation, he says, is it could be that greens indicate military victory. And one early sage wrote, early warriors and men of valor used to carry grass on their heads. One hero would make a crown or wreath on his head after he defeated his enemies. So I didn't really think about it, but he said that apparently the custom was that that military victors would wear, you know, these grass wreaths. So you start off with it like parsley or a celery or something green, some greenery, to indicate that we were victorious, that we fought this battle with God against the Egyptians and we won. His third explanation is that it is healthy and awakens us. Right? A little bit of vegetable salad at the beginning of the meal is good for you. And he says, why is it important to be healthy on Seder night? We don't normally associate the Seder night with our diets, but why is it important in theory? And he says, because the Jews have been sick and weak from slavery. So how do you emphasize that you're now healthy? By right? That you're not able to be healthy by having salad before you start the meal, right? It's we all know this, right? That that the lower classes in society tend to eat less healthy because they can't afford to, or they can afford the dollar menu at McDonald's, but not necessarily a $6 salad, which is not going to fill you up anyways before it, which is healthy and, you know, decreases your appetite when you get to the unhealthy part of the meal. Part of being wealthy or being free is that you can take care of your health, and salad is healthy. So that's his explanation. So what do we?
All their attempts to fill in this vacuum because there's no real answer.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. Right. So yeah.
There might be an answer. The drops are 800 to 1,000 years old. Nothing on this page indicates that at the time of in Babylonia, the Passover was also, as we did in Europe in recent times, associated with the local people who had the festival of spring, the Zoroastrians, and they celebrated spring and the rebirth of the land and green.
And vegetation. And this is also our spring holiday. I mean, it's Chag Aviv as well.
Holiday,
interesting. It could be. It could be. There are those who indicate this. I didn't put every explanation. I put like 10, I think. 10 to 8. Not 8. I put 8. Okay, I put 8 explanations. But you're right. There are other explanations. I'll just, you know, rattle some of them off. Some of them are, yes, as you said, that this is the beginning of the spring holiday, right? It's the Chag Aviv. Others say that it has, Karpas is the same letters backwards as Samach Perech, right? That it's Samach, which is 60, because there were 60 myriads of Jews in Egypt, Perech, who worked hard. Right, Perech meaning backbreaking labor, that they work beperech. So there are all types of other explanations that are given that we could keep going. I mean,
okay.
But yes, this is the second sort of methodological point I wanted to make about customs, is sometimes we don't know why customs happen, and therefore it's totally legitimate to fill it in with whatever is meaningful to you. In this case, we have those who say there is no meaning. And I'll add a point. One is that we see from this that that it's legitimate to give whatever explanations are meaningful to customs so that it resonates with you. The second thing I'll note about customs that this indicates is that, well, not about customs, rather, about Seder night, is that each of the explanation picks up on a different theme of Seder night legitimately. Right? So it's not just that we can pick up any explanation, but that customs are a great way of pulling out the themes of any given holiday or any given time period and accentuating those themes that speak to us. So if you look through them, you have the people who accentuate the importance of education on this night, like Reb Chizkiya da Silva. There is no reason. The point is just to get kids asking. There are other people who say that this emphasizes the freedom of the night in all different ways, either the freedom of the Jews or our current freedom. Maral of Prague focuses on the maror, that the centrality of the night is the actual mitzvah. Karpas is important because it serves a function for those central themes later in the Seder. The position of Rabbeinu Manoach connecting it to Joseph says that it's important to think on Seder night about why we're there, not just what happened in Egypt. So we educate ourselves as to the to not just what happened in Egypt, but why we came out and what we're supposed to learn from it. So you see that these explanations don't just randomly fill in the gap, is they actually fill in the gap by pulling on other themes from throughout the Seder. But it actually does even more than that. And this is what Rybrovsky notes nicely in 11. Rybrovsky is a teacher of my wife's and lived near us in Alon Shvut in Israel. So he's still, you know, he's still alive and young and writing. But he notes that it's actually interesting. It's not just here that we have multiple themes, but you actually have contradictory themes. Some of the people think that Karpas commemorates the slavery. Some people think it commemorates the freedom. So he notes this confusion regarding whether Karpas functions as a symbol of freedom or bondage has other halachic ramifications. Right? He notes that there are halachic nafkaminas to this. There are halachic ramifications to this. Is one to lean while eating Karpas? Is it dipped in charoset? All these are disputes, which according to the Talmud Bavli reminds us of mortar, and according to the Talmud Yerushalmi of blood, the cope dipped in blood. However, it seems that this confusion is typical of the Seder night, as we vacillate between two themes of freedom and slavery. While these two themes are themselves independently important, apparently they also cannot be separated from one another. One worthy of freedom is one who understands bondage. They aren't separate messages, but one complex message central to the Seder experience. So he argues the way should we experience is not pick one that's meaningful, but celebrate the paradox of Karpas, that Seder night is all about experiencing freedom and slavery at the same time. Therefore, the same symbol can be representative of both. Some of the commentaries say this is true of matzah as well, that matzah was the food eaten when we were slaves and the food that we ate when we left. Right? So it highlights both aspects. So he notes that in addition to having multiple different explanations, maybe that's part of the point of Karpas, is that we're celebrating freedom and slavery together, because to understand freedom, we need to understand slavery. And by understanding freedom, we can go back and understand the purpose of having been slaves. All of that comes together, so we should actually celebrate the paradoxical nature of the customs of the Seder. Now, in 12, I just gave you, and this was from that lecture by Yeshua Grunstein, where he notes that these different explanations should also have other ramifications. So, for example, if you think Karpas is a custom that we picked up just to express freedom, but it could have been just as easily anything else, so then that begs the question, so should we do other things that express freedom, like things that, you know, aren't listed in the Haggadah? Should we try to think of something that makes us feel free? Well, maybe yes. Right? If Karpas is just something we arbitrarily pick to make us feel free, so find something that makes you feel free, whatever it is. Right? If it means that, you know, you have your expensive, you know, diamond necklace that you only wear to fancy weddings, so maybe wear it Seder night. Right? The custom that the Talmud already says is to put out your best china on Seder night because you feel free. And some people I know actually do this. One of my wife's uncle and aunt, they actually don't use their china during the year. Their best china they save only for Pesach for this reason. But we can come up with other things.
How many of our mothers all put stuff away and said, I'm saving it for Pesach? And I'm sure everybody
did. Right.
None of us ever thought about why.
No. Right. And one of it is this.
It's interesting.
And he said, another thing he said is, if it's about, and he just notes, right, if it's about getting us hungrier, so then you would specifically need a light food, right? That's just one thing he knows, right? If it's anything else, so, you know, the parsley, let's say, is better than the potato. Okay, interesting. He notes that according to some of these explanations, Karpas doesn't necessarily have to be a vegetable, right? If it's just about eating a little bit before the meal, in theory, it could be anything else. If it's about the spring season, so sure, you need a green vegetable. If it's just about being hungry, so pick anything else. And in 1 second, we're going to see someone who did that. D is, does Karpas need to be specifically dipped? I mean, Karpas is dipped, but is the value of Karpas in the dipping or simply doing something different or eating something at the beginning, right? Could you accomplish the same goal by adding something else strange at the beginning of your Seder? Maybe yes, maybe no. Again, right, can you just do something strange? Okay, fine. In 13, here I put some, and here moving to our next area of customs, customs that you've never heard of, right? So I included a few just for fun. So there was a Rosh Yeshiva in Yeshiva University about 50, 60 years ago. His name was Rabbi Elazar Prale. His son-in-law was a very prominent rabbi in the States. He lived in Elizabeth, New Jersey. His name was Rabbi Pinchas Teitz. Now, when he came to America, there was a dispute amongst the rabbis. What blessing do you say on bananas? Is banana a fruit? And then you would say ha'eitz. Or do we treat it like a vegetable? Because bananas never, the tree, right? The tree regrows every year. It's not a real tree. So it's this in-between case. Is it a fruit? Is it a vegetable? For the purposes of brachot. He thought it was a vegetable. So what he did Seder night was he said, you know what? Karpas doesn't need a vegetable per se. I mean, it does need a vegetable. It needs, we use something that you say hadama. We use something that's technically a vegetable because, as Rabbi Yosef Tov Elam said, we want something that's going to be the same bracha as the maror later on. But he said a banana works. So he, and to this day, one of my very close friends is his grandson, right, Teitz's grandson. They use bananas at their Seder. Rabbi Turchiner, some of you know, uses a banana at his Seder because he said, if the goal of it is to get people to ask, so you put out the potato, the parsley, you're not surprising anyone. But I assure you that if you pull out a banana and dip it in salt water, your kids are going to start asking.
Or honey.
Right?
And honey?
What?
Salt
no,
water.
He doesn't. No, the salt water is another thing. Is it commemorates the tears? Right. We can't even get into every level of karpas. So that's one suggestion. If you want it, you know, take it or leave it. But some people do this just if you want to get the kids to ask. So switch it up once in a while. Bring out a banana, or if you like the parsley or potato, so bring a banana out also. See if people ask questions. They probably will. So that's just an interesting suggestion. And one of the rabbis in my parents' community. He said, well, you know what? I have a better suggestion. If karpas is just about getting people to ask by doing something strange, so he said, why don't you totally switch it up? Not to not do karpas, but he said, at this point in the Seder, you know what you should do? Start singing Maoz Tzur. I said, why? We all think of Maoz Tzur as a Hanukkah song, because the fifth stanza is Yevanim Nikbetzu Alai, that the Greeks, that they oppressed me, etc., etc. But what's the second stanza? I put it here. The second stanza is Raot Sava Nafshi Biagon Kolchi Kila, or the English is on the left. My soul was stated with misery, my strength was spent with grief, they embittered my life with hardship when enslaved under the rule of Egypt, but God with his mighty power brought out his treasured people, while Pharaoh's host and followers sank like a stone into the deep. The second stanza of Maoz Tzur is not about Hanukkah at all. It's about Passover. He said it makes about as much sense to say Maoz Tzur on Pesach and Hanukkah. We don't, but if you started singing Maoz Tzur, the first two stanzas, Seder night, you're going to get people to ask questions. And again, if the goal is to get people to ask questions, at some point, Karpas doesn't do it anymore because everyone knows Karpas is coming. But if you want to use Karpas as what it was traditionally, as an icebreaker, so shake it up a little bit, right? Bring a banana or, you know, sing Maoz Tzur at that point, right? There's no halachic basis to either of these. These are just customs that people do that I just point out will, in fact, shake up the Seder. So I figured they'd be fun to mention. Okay, so I think here, let's just summarize and then we'll move to your custom. We'll do the next three next week. Okay, so from the first custom, just to summarize, the standard explanation of the 16 drops was simply to mourn the loss of life that was inherent in the Exodus. We saw the original explanation has to do more with the mystical notion connecting to the theme of the night of protection, that we're invoking the power of God's 16-sided sword. Besides for the local issue of the Seder, what we can pull out from that is it emphasizes how much custom is not about law. It's about lived experience, which is why it's particularly susceptible to forgetting why it originally happened. The second thing you see from it is that the legitimacy and power of adding explanations to it, because this may not be the original explanation, but it definitely speaks to people, and I think that inherently is meaningful, since that's part of what drives the power of customs, is that they are a physical instantiation of that which we feel, and it brings it to life for us. And the third thing that we noted from that one is that the Seder night is about letting everyone get their say in because they might surprise you. And in this case, we all would have thought that if someone invented this explanation, it would be an Enlightenment thinker. It turns out it was a person from the most anti-Enlightenment part of the Jewish world, from Hungary in the 19th century, because you know what? People will always surprise you if you just give them the opportunity. In this case, we got surprised. Karpas, we noted about 10 different explanations. Whether there is no reason, it's an icebreaker. It emphasizes the freedom by letting us have salad before the meal, or because rich people dip and have hors d'oeuvres, or so that we'll have a little bit of food to go through the Seder, or because of the same bracha as the Maror, or to commemorate Joseph. It pulls at a few themes: A, remembering the slavery; B, remembering the freedom. The Joseph explanation emphasizes the fact that on Seder night we think not just about the fact that we are in Egypt, but why we were in Egypt and what we can learn from the lessons of Egypt. And as Rybrovsky notes, the dual explanation of Karpas is nice because Seder night is all about that paradox of celebrating freedom and slavery at the same time, because they help us experience each, they mutually help us experience the other. And then the last thing we noted is that if, again, Seder night and Karpas in specific is about getting people to ask, it is also worth thinking about, can we come up with our own way of getting people to ask and shaking things up Seder night? I threw out two that I happen to know of. One is using the banana, and one is the singing of Mao Tzur. But again, you can come up with whatever it is. As we see, according to Chizkia da Silva, Karpas has no reason except to shake things up. So if you have something else that's going to shake things up, whatever it might be, that's what Seder night's about. You want people to be engaged, whatever it takes. Okay, so next week we'll do the next three. We have 5 minutes left. Please, I'll turn the floor over.